Many things to consider, but I hope we don't see, when you're comparing trust with banks, that we don't start seeing trading data futures and things like that, which will bring down the whole system. Perhaps we've got some lessons to learn from the current situation. Quite a lot has been shared, quite a lot of detail too, issues. We've obviously heard about clouds, we've heard about trust, we've heard about semantics. I think we've also picked up the interoperability and multidisciplinary nature of all that's going on. These are some of the key features, and I think one of the things that came about through Riding the Wave was very much it's going to alter the way research is done, not just what goes on underneath, as it were, but how people are going to interact and how we take that forward. So I did warn the panel that they've got a few seconds just to bring out one or two points to emphasize, to remind you again, and then it's over to you, because there's at least 40 minutes between you and a drink, so you've got to fill it in somehow. Michael, can we start with you?
There's two points to bring out. One is clouds, we need to not be afraid of them. We need to see how we can leverage them. The other is in trust, and you know, looking specifically about some of the stuff that was just brought up in terms of trust in clouds. I agree we need to trust the clouds, but let's think about why do we trust when you get an operating system from Microsoft or IBM that it's actually doing what you think it is and keeping your data, or you get a piece of hardware from Oracle, IBM, right? Who actually knows what's happening on that processor, right? Who here actually knows? How do you know it's actually doing what it says it's doing, right? So let's remember that we're already putting a lot of blind trust in a lot of technology, and let's think to ourselves why we're willing to do it in a lot of levels of technology that already are out there, and yet we have this fear of something called the cloud.
Thank you, Michael. Monica.
Okay. I'll pick up on the data scientist that I very quickly mentioned at the end of my talk, because I think that, you know, as we recognize the importance of data in the research nowadays, we need, I think, this is my perspective, a curriculum or someone who knows how to manage data in the appropriate way. And I think that it goes back to best practices, but I think it also goes back to understanding what the main challenges are when dealing with large amount of data. And as I was trying to point out, this is not just storage, this is a whole field where we are all learning. What I see is that the many, many people are trying to manage data with the experience and the knowledge they have from their disciplines. But I wonder whether the game changer could be, you know, the idea of having a more in-depth understanding of how data needs to be curated, manipulated, and so on. And then I would like to pick up on what Michael just said about trust, which came out in all of the four presentations. And I always wonder how much psychological barriers play a game in this type of exercise. How much we are ready to give out what we produce, and whether it's, because I don't think that the technology is an issue. It's really, you know, are we ready to do so? What is the price that we have to pay, if any?
Thank you. Tony, you ready for something?
Yes. Yeah. I'd like to pick up Monica's data scientist and the training issue. I think there really is an opportunity, because one of the reasons is that industry has recognized that big data is going to be lots of industrial data with value if you can search it, if you can mine it, if you can use, you know, sophisticated machine learning tools. So I think that big data will ensure that there is a demand by industry for well-trained data scientists, and people will be encouraged to go and do that. And I think they can actually learn their trade by working in a scientific discipline, and some of them actually stay in the discipline. So I'm hoping they can do that. And if they can do that, they need to help produce some demonstrable wins for doing all this work on data, that actually it does deliver value. So data scientists and training, and really the students will educate their advisors, who will educate their heads of department. And so that's the way you change universities, I believe.
Yeah, I think I would emphasize that because we talk a lot about the added value of doing all of this. Unless we can show it, and especially in this country in economic terms, which I don't necessarily always agree with, but that's what we've got to show. Christopher, last call.
So one thing I wanted to convey in my talk in here is that the infrastructures we're talking here about are not just things to put data in. They're really, really a new way of doing computing. When I was a student 20 years ago, we had access to some of the best supercomputers in the world as students. Basically, university computers were much more interesting what you could find outside the industry. This has changed. I think today it is a bit boring when you use university computers and you have exciting computers in companies. And it would be a good thing to change this back, especially the computers we used 20 years back, we used for simulations, because that was the one thing that we could do very well on supercomputers. Weather simulation, hydrodynamics, wind tunnels, atomic bombs, whatever. That was basically what these computers were being used for. Today, if you build an e-infrastructure and make it accessible for researchers, especially researchers at university in a large scale, so that basically every research institute can have access to large data storage and processing, you actually enable them to process data. We are acquiring data at a huge rate. Very much of this data is really, really important and interesting, with climate data, with biodiversity data, with social data of people moving around, how our cities work, with data about how in the UK, how the government works, where money is spent. Now all this, and I hope that I can convey that the infrastructures you are building here can be really, really central for students and researchers to develop new things to do with this data. And they need some way to actually work with these large amounts of data in an easy way. And having a central infrastructure makes that much easier than making people download and buy computers for themselves and have everybody organize it. That sense, the infrastructure is a really competitive thing for Europe. And we are here from the centers of four American companies that have all strong labs in Europe. And I can tell you that nobody out of a Google lab here in Europe, and in London, Zurich, or Munich, thinks, or Paris, thinks that we are second-rate citizen in our companies. Europe is very, very strong in computer science. It has not produced a Google or an IBM or a Microsoft or an Oracle, but it has produced SAP and quite a lot of other companies. And it has produced a large amount of very, very strong people doing research in computer science. For example, about half of the programming languages being used today, and especially some of the most modern ones, like Scala, come out of European universities. Even inside Google, one of our two new languages, Dart, has been developed in the Aarhus office. So there's really an opportunity for Europe to do something, both for the research side and in the end, this is something that will be economically important in the future.
Well, thank you very much indeed. We've had a lot of ideas from up here, and perhaps we can have the lights up a little bit so I can see somebody stake forward. Now, you can either voluntarily contribute or I'm going to select you to contribute. But just whilst you're thinking about that, on the Imperial website, the staff website, I just noticed that a talk is being given by Professor Keith Jeffrey called Spies, Secrets and Science, Reflections on the History of MI6. So we're talking about trust, Keith. There's your man, but the picture of you doesn't look the same, unfortunately, so it probably isn't you. When I was head of department at Nottingham, we used to have the head of materials from Rolls-Royce come and do it wasn't a lecture, an exercise with our students. And he deliberately set up a real-life situation where some of the data that students were given was false, because that was what was in the literature. And students would complain. He said, but that's how it is. And we need to train people how to actually access this whole new environment as well. So come on, otherwise I'm going to pick on you. Yeah, Simon.
Hi, Simon Hodson from JISC, Managing Research Data Program. I find the quotation from Professor Schofield that Tony Hay alluded to incredibly eloquent. I mean, I think it gets to the real nub of one of the most important problems. That quotation, I can get the funding to put equipment into the ocean, but not to analyze that data on the back end. And the fact that that particular research group say that the core of their frustration is that they can't apply for they don't seem to be able to apply for the support required. The point I want to make about that is that links very very well to the issue which was raised by the panel and raised by many of the presentations about the role of the data scientist. It's the activity of a data scientist within the research group as the human infrastructure, if you like, the expertise, as well as the technical infrastructure which needs to be resourced. So, the question, how to unpick that Gordian knot, how to make sure that that aspect can be resourced effectively within a research project.
Thanks very much, Simon. That's a very important point. I've been talking to one or two librarians, including my own back at Imperial, about how this might be done. So ideas on that would be gratefully received. Librarians in the audience, do they wish to respond?
Well, I think I could say something. Mm. I think, as Martha explained, the OSTP, the White House, are seriously investing in coercing the agencies to cooperate on data and have data management plans and so on. And I think that is changing the climate, there are recognitions certainly within NSF. I'm on the Advisory Committee for Cyber Infrastructure Unit, that they are thinking about, yes, if you build open source software, you have to actually maintain it and document it. If you have data, you have actually to store it and save some of it. So I think these things are beginning to be costed, and I think it's only the beginnings. And I think there are things that actually the US at this moment can learn some things from Europe.
Can I add? Oh, sorry.
Please.
Yeah, so what Simon just said, actually, in terms of funding, I think that just reiterates and support the idea of the e-infrastructure, because in the e-infrastructure, we should have services related to digital archiving and preservation. And many times I was confronted to statements like, you know, we have small science versus big sciences. Big science or big disciplines get more funding than small sciences. I think that, you know, in the ideal world or in the medium term, if we had such an infrastructure, we could definitely speed up the research and the quality of research that these sciences, that disciplines that are, you know, for one reason or another getting less funding or are able to get less funding, could be, you know, step forward in their way of doing research.
I would just add to this that I think a critical prerequisite to this is to figure out and be able to estimate how much it costs to keep the data. I think a lot of researchers expect that for £50 they can put away a terabyte for forever, because they can buy a disk for £50 per terabyte. And it's clear that it isn't 50 terabytes a pound, but I don't think anyone knows how much it does cost or knows how to predict how much it'll cost to keep the data over time. And in particular, if you want to start being able to not just keep the data, but actually be able to use it, do analytics on it, right? How much does that cost? And how much value do you get to your data? And how do you do that equation? And how do you prove that it's actually a win situation and you can, you know, make money out of keeping the data as opposed to simply having it be a cost sink?
I just wanted to make a comment that David Rosenthal, many of you may know him, he's at Stanford. He blogged about this recently, so I encourage you to go find it, but he is working on a model for doing that very kind of thing to try to balance the decisions we make today about storage and long-term care against opportunities in the future. And he developed this kind of very clever model that takes into account all these black swans of financial vicissitudes. But the University of California at Santa Cruz is interested in, they're trying to get together a research group to further the concepts that he's come up with. But he has a rough running model that you could look at. It's on his blog, David Rosenthal.
Thank you very much. I mean, one of the key questions is not just the data management plan, but what it's actually going to be monitored and kept going. Kevin, have you got any thoughts on this from the DCC?
Yes.
You see what I...
I had my hand half raised, indeed, waiting to
no,
intervene.
No,
Kevin, actually...
You were spotted, as well.
Digital Creation Center. I mean, coming back, perhaps, and following up on that point around the... you know, what the funders are willing to cost and whether or not, you know, you can get paid for the instruments and not paid for the cost of curating the data. I wonder whether, in fact, I think funders are willing to fund those costs during the lifetime of a project, but there is often a tension, I think, between people feel that, you know, every time you fund something like that, you're somehow doing less research. And so I think that the fault perhaps lies equally there between the funders and those putting the proposals together about thinking creatively how to present the cost. But where the real issue comes for many of us is indeed in the sustaining the data beyond the life of the funded project. And we've heard this word infrastructure mentioned a lot of times, and it's the right way to think about having an infrastructure for the maintenance of data. Infrastructures like telephones, you know, and other utilities, and the problem is that in the context of funding, those things are overheads. So even assuming that we had the skills and that we understood the costs to put in place good research infrastructure within universities, say, the problem then is that raises overheads. And certainly there's a nervousness, I think, in the UK at the moment amongst some institutions that whoever takes the first step suddenly begins to look expensive compared to their peers. They are putting in place better infrastructure, and as a result they have higher overheads, and therefore they worry perhaps they're going to lose out compared to the people who don't have that infrastructure in place. And that's somehow a problem that we need to overcome.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much the same concept, presumably, in the early days about libraries, but they've all been absorbed, and so it's a cultural thing as well as anything else. Yes, at the front here, please. Very front row. Sorry, I can't. It'll get to you eventually. I'd like to prime people in the, maybe people from CSC in Finland, and also the STM, Barbara, perhaps to have some thoughts as well.
I'm Hans Pfeifenberger from Helmholtz. I just wanted to, remark, if anything is in place, we have data scientists who help scientists to actually cost their data infrastructure, and if funders actually require that to be the case, I wonder if not the whole big mass of data will suddenly vanish in a way, because actually they have to pay for it. Let's take this example of the gene sequences, the next generation sequences. Everybody has said, well, the cost of producing just one sequence is dropping so fast, but the cost of disks is not dropping as fast as that, and so we cannot store the data. That's rubbish, of course. It implies that you have a fixed budget for sequencing and a fixed budget for storing, and this cannot work, of course. But if you combine both budgets, you suddenly begin thinking, or scientists should begin thinking about, well, do we really need to store all that data? And I think the next generation sequencers have already, in using those, it has already been dropped to store all of what could be taken from it, just storing the derived data. So this might be a result also perhaps with, let's say, health data, or so, if they are to be actually factored into the whole cost.
Thank you very much. We'll hear more about that tomorrow when Andy Lyle comes to talk about Elixir, because this is very much a point. Did I see something at the back there? Yes, thank you.
Hello, my name is Peter Doorn from Data Archiving Network Services in the Netherlands. Dark suits and impressive buildings may create a bit of trust, but I would say that the basic thing that creates trust in money banks is that the money that you put there, that you get that back at some time, and preferably also with some interest. Now, we know, of course, that banks, money banks, do something with your money. But one of the things that is influencing the trust in clouds is that you do not exactly know what the data banks, if I may call the clouds as such, what they do with the data that you put there. But suppose that we could trust that nothing really happens with the data that you put there, then I still wonder whether the states, the national states, that ultimately are the places where the servers are stored, and that may be one of the replicas where your data end up, For instance, if data that I would put in the cloud, confidential data, would be on a server in the United States, isn't it so that it will ultimately fall under the Patriot Act and that the American state could claim that data if they think it is of interest for the national security? And isn't that a reason why public clouds are under construction in several countries? And the last thing that I wanted to remark about the cloud solutions that are presently offered commercially is that they are not yet commercially interesting, I think, for the science community because of the enormous costs when we are really talking about high volumes of data.
You want to respond? Anybody? Yeah. Let Monica go.
Okay. I think that this is a very relevant point. I can give you an anecdote from Oracle. Is it on now? Okay. So very simple example. We have some, what I would say, cloud services that we offer. And up until we acquired Sun, these services that, you know, we used to call on-demand, but it's very much, you know, like cloud, you know, depending on the different the definition that you use, but this is effectively a cloud service, were hosted in Austin or in other places in the U.S., and many of our customers were very reluctant in using these services, exactly for the reason you alluded to. With the Sun acquisition, we inherited a large computing center in Linlithgow in Scotland, and all of a sudden this opened up for us huge opportunities because people are now complying with some EU rules that are, you know, all of a sudden trusting us more. So I think that this is an issue to which I don't have an ideal answer. This was, you know, a workaround that worked pretty well. It was convenient. I wonder whether time and technology will allow us in, you know, maybe a short-term future to do things in a better way and be trusted. Because again, I go back to my psychological barriers, and we saw that also with grids. You know, the time that it takes to go to that level is not equal to zero.
Let me also point out and restate something I stated, right? I mean, when you're talking about cloud, what you're thinking about are these large public clouds. Right, but clouds are not just large public clouds. They're also private clouds. And if you can't trust your private cloud, that means you can't trust your own data center. Right? And we need to not equate clouds with just one extreme of the spectrum. Now, that extreme of the spectrum has benefits, but it's still an extreme of the spectrum. And a community cloud is built upon organizations which have agreed to trust themselves. Right? And when you look at things that are offered by industry, IBM, for instance, has what we call a smart cloud archive, which is a cloud solution that is a semi-private cloud, which is aimed at meeting regulatory requirements, including geographic placement of constraints on placement of data, and will keep data within a particular geography by using data centers within that geography. And I know that IBM is not the only one that has those solutions. I think that the issue is with cloud. Is we all think, when we think about cloud, at one extreme end of the spectrum, right? And not realize that cloud is a delivery model, and we shouldn't equate cloud with a particular implementation, but rather think of it as a delivery model which gives us pay-as-go, gives us that network access, gives us flexibility, and let it be implemented in different ways, in different constraints, and sort of how broadly open it is.
Right. So I think my point with trust and titles was that you're completely right to ask these questions. If you put your data in an infrastructure, you have the right to know where the data is, what's being done with the data, and the assumption that if you're told the data is that in that place and we are not doing anything with your data, we're not mining it, that's what happens. There is the issue with the local jurisdiction. I talked to some of our lawyers. It's very complicated. There are technical solutions, basically, by just putting the data inside the EU. That's possible. There are ways to guarantee you that your data doesn't leave the EU. I'm not sure that makes a big practical difference. I don't think the problem of being, if the NSA is going after you in the US, that might be a bigger issue that basically the governments can sort out, the lawyers can sort out. It would be useful to have some sort of a regulatory security for clouds, how you what you can do and what you cannot do. And a lot of people in Brussels are working on that. In the end, it is your right to know how the data is stored, where it is stored, what risks the data undergo, which jurisdiction they are under. And you should really ask these things. And I should have said that when I made my presentation. We are not even that much in the business of selling clouds. I made this presentation about our infrastructure to give you a feeling what the infrastructures look like. I would very much like to see public clouds going up. It will create an ecosystem that will be very good for business, even if you don't use commercial clouds. It's very important right now to have these things available for research in universities without thinking about who sells it.
Juan, I think, is next.
Thank you. Could I just reassure the last speaker that we have a data center in Amsterdam? It's okay.
Oh, sorry. Where are you? Okay, Juan.
Thank you. It's very interesting to have the perspective from four different companies on the stage, but I'd like to pick up Christoph's analogy about the banks as well and the issue of trust, but not so much at the level of the infrastructure, but rather at the level of keeping data in a repository. In the bank example, it's already been said that it's partly very amazing that we trust the bank not only to take our money and give it back to us, but actually to give it to somebody else in the interim, do something with it, and still be able to give it back to us when we ask for it. And as such, the banks are acting as a broker between somebody's money and somebody else who needs it. And this looks rather like data sharing, perhaps, where in the data sharing perspective, we're not really looking for value in terms of money, perhaps, but in terms of the scientific benefit that can be got from the bank and the repository, and how can we maximize the benefit that we can get from this brokering service the repository can do. So I think I'm just trying to push that analogy as far as possible and say, well, what would we want of a repository if we're going to maximize the benefit we can get from putting the data there? We would want the repository to somehow broker the lending of the data, in inverted commas, to other bodies. And what we get back from a bank is, of course, a share in the financial benefit and the interest that can be made by sharing the data. What we'd want back from the repository is a share in the scientific kudos that will be got from the sharing of that data with other parties. So I think from the perspective of that analogy, it's really a very strong one. If we look at it as what value can we get from brokering the relationship between data holders and data users.
Well, absolutely right. The idea of citing data, which is effectively the interest, and I think, was it you, Tony, talking about data cite?
Data cite.
Yes, which was there. Next door to Juan and then Keith.
Yes, my name is Jussi Nuorteva. I'm National Archivist of Finland. We have been in the European Archives Group discussing very much the question of trusted repositories. And I think that when we are looking at the governmental records management and preservation of the governmental documents, that is the duty of the National Archives. But when we look at the science side, then the question, what is really a trusted repository? That's a very open question, so that even if your research data finally comes to some repository, that doesn't mean necessarily that it is a trusted repository. David Jaretta has been raising very much a question of certification system, that we need criteria to show what repositories are really trusted repositories, because we are also risking the research data if we are not able to, not only to guarantee the preservation, but also to guarantee the accessibility of the data in the long run. And I think that it is also one of the questions that when we are speaking about the evolution of the repositories, everybody is understanding the situation today. But I think that it's a question also of cost efficiency, so that how many repositories do we really need, how they are able to cooperate, how they are really building up the cloud so that we can share the resources. And I think that it's one of the major issues that we should more discuss also within APA and also wider. We have a limited number of organizations that are participants and members of the APA. It would be good to have a wider mandate also from the research organizations.
Yeah, there's always tension there, and I think we felt it here in the UK. I won't try and stir the thing up again because I'm blooded by it myself. Keith.
Thanks. I wanted to add a little bit about the cloud. Referring to Michael's slide where you showed five scenarios, that the big problem that we addressed, I should explain, I've just come a month or so ago from running the second expert group on clouds in the EU. And the problem we're trying to address is the connection between your scenarios 2 and 4, which is a very common one. That is, a private cloud, maybe with hosted service from a supplier, linked to a more public cloud, but not a fully public cloud. Because that's a very common scenario. You want the elasticity of the semi-public cloud linked to your private cloud for reasons of either high-power computation, high-throughput computation, or what we're discussing here, digital preservation, i.e. an off-site environment for that. And the problems that I think are there, some have already been mentioned, security, privacy, and so on, the problem of the legalistics across national boundaries. But the other one we really came up with as a problem is data shift, the problem of moving data from your private cloud into this public cloud at whatever frequency, just because the data centers operate at a very high rate and the bandwidth between them tends to be many orders of magnitude lower. So we saw that as a real barrier that needs to be overcome. And after a little analysis, it seemed to be that the technology is there. It's the telcos that are not releasing the bandwidth that they have already because of commercial reasons. They can make enough money with their present restricted bandwidth environment. So we've been pushing the European Commission to push, in turn, the telcos to release more bandwidth so that clouds can become more into the mainstream of computing.
So I think there is an issue, and I'm not sure how much that is the issue as a global issue. I mean, one of the things you see in the United States, for instance, is with the prevalence of YouTube and Netflix, a huge amount of the bandwidth has all of a sudden been consumed, where there was sort of an overabundance of bandwidth that's now being used to see old episodes of The Simpsons. And I'm not sure how much additional bandwidth, but I think even if the bandwidth is there, there is an issue with data in that it takes time to move data, right? And moving it over a WAN in particular takes a long time. And one of the very important things you're doing when you're having a distributed environment is you need to make sure you move the data as little as possible. You put it where it needs to be, and then you move the computation to the data. But I'm not going to tell you this is a solved problem, because it's not.
Okay, I think we've got time for one more contribution. I noticed nobody on the right-hand side has said anything. Is somebody raising a hand there? Yes, well done.
Yes. Is it working?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I've been sitting today listening to all of you. And the impression I get is, of course, of the complexity of the problems of digital preservation, the capillarity, all the different questions that you have to address. When we wrote the Digital Libraries Initiative in 2005, we looked at the issues of legal challenges, the issues of organizational challenges, the issues of financial challenges, technological challenges. And I mean, I think those issues are there. Probably bigger because the amount of information is bigger. Now, my suggestion to a person and to is really now that there is a big opportunity to try to focus a bit all these discussions in some concrete things that can be done. And we are now especially in the science part with Horizon 2020 that is now being discussed. And in the connecting European facilities that is going to be supporting e-infrastructures, I think there's a good opportunity to sharp some things that should be done in order to improve the situations. So if we're talking about research, what should be the boundary of the research projects we are funding in the European Commission? For example, should data management be a compulsory question in the program? So basically, final payment would only be issued when data is packed and nicely put in a nice ribbon, and then that will have to be sent to someone else. But at least we can, at least at European level, start doing a data management plan. And that could be one of the things that could be done. on one side. Then we have the question of what technologies we need, and I think that is quite important. I mean, I haven't heard much today about what are the problems of developing new tools and the like. I think there's also a good opportunity to make that case. And I would invite David and Aparshan to really look into this and do a bit of road mapping and what are the key issues that we should be funding in the next 3 or 4 years on this. Then there's going to be money for infrastructures. And I mean, at European level, not that much. I think this is more a question of national levels. But again, in the Connecting European Facilities, the Capacities Program, my friend Kostas Glinos will be here tomorrow, so he will be certainly very keen to get ideas from you. But my invitation to you now is to really try all these discussions to focalize them. The time is ripe now. The Commission finishes its big programs next year, in the month of this year, in the month of June. And then 2012 will be the time that we will be discussing with the Parliament and with the Council the amount of money that we will get. And at the same time, in parallel, we're going to be starting thinking about the work programs and the action lines of for the different actions, because in 2013 all those things have to be organized, settled, calls launched, and I mean work starts in 2013, so it's not that far away. So the opportunity is now, really. So try to get all that thing, and through a person, I think we have a network of excellence, which is a wonderful opportunity to put all these things together and try to really sharpen some priorities. And of course, I mean, the work that has been done for cultural institutions is one thing, science is another thing, other types of preservation is another thing, health and data privacy is another thing. I mean, that all those things can be tackled in different programs, in different areas, but I invite you really to try to concretize a bit what should be done at European level, why should it be done at European level, the added value that this would bring at European level. And of course, anything that can be done on economics is crucial. How much does it cost? I mean, we were in a debate 2 or 3 years ago about who should be funding, and it seems the question is still open. No one wants to fund at the beginning of the year to preserve data. So everybody funds projects, but we don't fund preservation of data. I think that issue, we should continue bringing some evidence in about the benefits of this, how data is reused, what is the cost of not preserving data, if you want to put it that way. But I mean, we have to really continue on that. So I really would invite to use a Parsons, a very big project. We have put a lot of money, over 7 or 8 million euros on there, so you have a wonderful platform in order to make David work and work hard and make sure that we really get sharp deliverables and sharp ideas that we can really use for the benefit of all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's a good point to end on, Javier. And in fact, I was actually going to say that you wanted us to take the thing forward. Absolutely underline that now is the critical month to actually get your ideas as APA, David, into the Commission, because on the 5th and 6th of December, there will be the Innovation Summit, and that's where everything will happen after that. So various groups are putting their ideas in at this moment, and it's good to be strong and positive. Also to make sure you write it in a way that politicians understand. Because if you don't, then you have another uphill argument. I brief the Budgetary Committee quite often, and if you keep it to 2 pages, that's enough. So can I thank all? No, it's true. Make sure it's short and sharp about what really is required, because otherwise it doesn't go anywhere, despite the stuff that comes out of the Commission, I should say. Tony. Last word, because yep. We have to get out.
Yeah, just one dimension that's not mentioned in the report, which is actually, I think, the role of the great research libraries at universities in Europe, and that's what Driver and COAR is about. Yeah. And I think that they can do sort of lots of copies, keep stuff safe, and they have a role to play in document and data preservation, yep. In my view, and they already have a budget.
Yeah, and certainly the librarians I talk to in that group are very aware of the situation. Okay, can I thank all the speakers up here for Tony, Michael, Monica, and Christoph. I will be with you again tomorrow afternoon if any of you are still here, but we need to move out of this room pretty promptly. And the drink's already ready, I understand. Is that right, David? If you don't get out, you won't get any dinner. So I suggest you get out quick. Thank you very much indeed.